Hello and welcome to this summary of the joint IASB-FASB board meeting held in Norwalk on the 19th and the 20th of October 2011. I'm joined by Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities, and Steve Cooper, Member of the IASB. Hello, gentlemen. Okay, let's go straight on then. Alan, would you like to begin by talking about impairment?
Yep, sure. Obviously, the impairment aspect or part of IFRS 9 replacement is very important to both boards. The boards have struggled a little bit over the last several months to basically develop a model that is both conceptually sound and also able to be applied in practice. And what it's come down to is that, if those who recall, we looked at three different buckets or categories of loans in terms of those that, using my terms as opposed to the board's, but those that that basically are performing well at the moment, those that perhaps are under more intense management so that we've got some concerns about them, and those that perhaps have deteriorated to the point that they are troubled loans. And the question is how we allocate loans initially to one of these categories and then move them from one category to the other. Now, what's the good news is that last week when the board met, they decided that the overall objective should be for any sort of expected loss model, which is what we're talking about, to be based on deterioration of the credit quality of the financial assets. In other words, if you're in the business of originating loans to a lower quality type of customer, for example, so it has a lower credit rating, it still goes into that initial bucket of saying, well, we've built into the pricing our expected losses, so it will still be in the bucket one or the highest category. And it's only when it deteriorates that we actually start to recognise the whole of life losses for those particular loans. Now, we've still got quite a bit of work to do, but at least the staff now, once you've got that principle in place, what we have to have a look at is how we actually measure deterioration, what sort of characteristics or features we look for, and then how we might measure, obviously, the lifetime losses are there. The other aspect of it is that even with loans that you originate and place into this first untroubled category, you still, in your pricing, you're expecting over your portfolio some of those won't pay out fully. And so we have to work out whether there's, you know, previously one of the ISB models was to take a time proportionate approach and allocate. It's whether we do something, for example, to take 12 months worth of losses as a practical expedient. So that's essentially what the staff is going away to have a look at.
I think it's important that we don't understate the difficulties that we have in this area, and I think people realise the problems that there are given the time it's taken and the number of models we've been looking at. And it is a challenge to try and find an approach that it is both operational from the perspective of banks, but also that reflects as well as possible the underlying economics of the business. And we went into this meeting with the staff presenting a whole load of papers, looking at an absolute approach. I think that would have been more operational, but presented all sorts of difficulties when it came to trying to really reflect the business, and we would have had exceptions and different techniques to apply in different circumstances. So the board has taken all that into account and come up with a way forward that is by no means certain. The staff been asked to go away and do a lot more work on this, but hopefully that's going to present us with a solution to this difficult problem.
Right. I think the positive thing is that until this meeting, the two boards didn't even have agreement on absolute versus relative model, and I think this is the first time we've had that agreement.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, perhaps we go on to insurance. Steve?
Yeah, we had a long session on insurance, primarily fixed fee service contracts, presentation of the statement of financial position, and also the presentation of statement of comprehensive income. For fixed fee service contracts, this is essentially the boundary of where we apply insurance accounting compared with where we apply revenue recognition. And it probably doesn't make a great deal of difference in terms of measurement, particularly where we have the premium allocation approach that's used. However, it is important in terms of the level of disclosure that is applied and one or two aspects of measurement, particularly acquisition costs. So we've ended up with a tentative decision about when we would treat something as a fixed fee service contract and apply revenue recognition. We've developed some criteria. Contracts are not priced on the assessment of risk associated with an individual customer. Contracts compensate customers by providing a service rather than giving a cash payment. The type of risk transferred by the contracts are primarily related to the utilization or frequency of services relative to the overall risk transferred. So those are the three criteria. Essentially, it means that things like roadside assistance would be treated as a fixed fee service contract, whereas you can there is an element of insurance in there. You pay a fixed fee and you get roadside assistance however many times your car breaks down. So there's an insurance element to it, but I think most people would say that it's not worth our while applying insurance accounting. So these criteria are designed to try and separate things into those where revenue recognition is appropriate and those where insurance accounting is necessary. On presentation of statements of financial position, this is all about which components of insurance liabilities need to be shown separately in the statement of financial position or the notes. And it's to do with the analysis of the insurance liability. So, for example, separately disclosing the risk margin, the risk adjustment, and the residual margin within the building block approach from the expected cash flows. And we've said that separation should be done either in the statement of financial position or the notes. It also involves separation of the liability measured under the building block approach from the liability measured under the premium allocation approach. And we've said that those should be presented separately on the face of the statement of financial position. And also the level to which we can aggregate. So we've said that portfolios that are in an asset position should not be aggregated with portfolios that are in a liability position. Asset position is unusual for insurance portfolios, but can arise in the early stages of a contract where, for example, there's significant acquisition costs. So we've sorted out where things should go in the notes and on the face of the statement. Lastly, statement of comprehensive income. This is more of a challenge. And in fact, we have asked the staff to do some more work on this. It's a challenge because of the different ways in which the building block approach and the premium allocation approach present performance. One's essentially a release of margin and the other one is premiums and claims. I think the board's decided that we would want to present premiums, claims, benefits and gross underwriting margin in the statement of comprehensive income. But it's a question of whether they have to be disclosed separately and perhaps differently for the two measurement approaches or whether they can be combined. And the staff are going to go away and do some more work on this.
Okay. Perhaps, Steve, we could stay with you if you wouldn't mind talking a little about the discussion on revenue recognition.
Revenue recognition, that was a relatively short session dealing with interim disclosures. We've essentially finished the revenue recognition exposure draft and it will be published shortly. I'll perhaps say what the timing of that is. But there was one final issue that we had to consider, and that is the extent to which the disclosure requirements apply to interim financial statements. Now, for the IASB, interims are dealt with by IAS 34, and we have a principle and some specific disclosures which are asked for there. So we didn't have to amend IAS 34 as part of this project, but I think there were some that felt that we need to clarify exactly what is or isn't required there. So whilst the general principle of IAS 34 continues to apply, updating information where necessary from the previous annual financial statements, we have specified a list of items which would be required disclosures. Now, these are listed in an update. I'm not going to go through all of them, but it includes, for example, a disaggregation of revenue, which is one of the required disclosures in the annual financial statements. That would also be required within the interim financial statements. And there were certain other individual disclosures that we're suggesting as well.
And I think one of the reasons for having to have a look at this in perhaps more detail than we normally would is that the US GAAP approach is different to IAS 34, whereas we have the principle of allowing for updating from the annual report, they tend to have a lot more detail. And in fact, just as a brief aside, they actually did review their other comprehensive income disclosure requirements in terms of putting information on the face, because it was going to affect their quarterly reporting significantly. So they've actually just pushed back on one section of the other comprehensive income exposure requirements that are about to come into effect in the US.
Okay. Just one major project left there, and that's leases. Alan, perhaps you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, we spent nearly a full day on leases, so we had a look at both lessor accounting and lessee accounting. Yeah, this is, as you said, one of the two major projects that we're expecting to publish our re-exposures on. You mentioned revenue recognition a minute or so ago, and that's expected out in the next 3 or 4 weeks. Leases won't be out until around about February, because we've still got to go through our balloting processes. But we had the last, major issues, at least in terms of scope, and having a look at some of the transition elements. So perhaps I'll start by looking at the lessor accounting. Two of the scope issue here was investment properties, and basically both boards decided that a lessor's lease of investment property would not be within the scope of the receivable residual value residual approach. And essentially what you do is they would continue to recognise their investment property and recognise income over the lease term. So they essentially get transferred, or they don't go into the leasing standard, they just stay within the investment property standard. The board's also discussed the receivable and residual approach for lease contracts, and essentially a lessor is going to recognise, at least initially, the right to receive lease payments. And to do that, they're going to take the lease payments and discount them at the present value based on the rate that the lessor charges the lessee. Okay. Once you've done that, in subsequent periods, you deal with that at amortized cost, applying an effective interest rate method. So I think that's consistent with our FI accounting. Secondly, you're going to measure the residual asset as an allocation of the carrying amount of the underlying asset. Now, what the board's decided this time is that the initial measurement of the residual asset is going to have two amounts. First of all, it's the gross residual asset, okay, and we're going to measure that at the amount you expect to receive for it, the residual value at the end of the lease term, but it's going to be discounted back to the present value. And again, that's using the rate that the lessor charges the lessee. And the other component's the deferred profit, and that's basically the difference between the gross residual asset and the allocation of the carrying amount of the underlying asset. Now, after you've done the initial recognition, subsequently, you're going to take that residual asset and accrete it back up until you get to the amount you would expect at the end of its life to the amount of cash you should get for it. You don't recognise any of the deferred profit and loss until the asset's sold or leased. And essentially, in terms of presentation, the gross residual asset and the deferred profit are going to be bundled together as a net residual asset. And yeah, I think that's the main issues to start with lessor accounting. Perhaps we looked at variable lease payments as well, I think, didn't we?
Yeah, variable lease payments from the perspective of the lessor were considered. The difficulty with this is that the initial measurement of the receivable and the residual doesn't take into account most variable lease payments, which is a consequence of an earlier decision. So effectively, the variable lease payments are within the residual asset. The residual asset is higher as a result of those variable lease payments. So when you receive a variable lease payment, the question becomes, is the credit going to go to the income statement as an additional amount of income, or is the credit going to go against the residual asset because effectively you're monetizing part of that residual asset? And we've come up with an approach that it depends. It depends whether the variable lease payments were taken into account initially as part of the pricing of the lease. There was an expectation of variable lease payments. If that's the case, then to the extent that is the case, you would show the variable lease payments as a credit against the residual asset. If that's not the case, and maybe the variable lease payment is effectively compensation for additional usage of that asset, then we would say that it's not affecting the residual, and we would recognise it in income immediately. So perhaps a somewhat convoluted or complex approach by the sound of it, but there is certainly some logic in terms of the underlying economics of variable lease payments.
Yeah, and probably the most common example that you know, we hear about is something like a car lease, where they put in a protective constraint of something like 10,000 miles or kilometres a year is built into the lease payments. Anything above that, they actually charge essentially a penalty, in a sense, for extra usage, and that would just be recognised as income. Now, if you can say, well, there's extra wear and tear on the car, the impairment testing will look after that aspect of it.
There is an interaction between the decision on variable lease payments and the lessor accounting model, and we did consider different approaches for each. So these two tentative decisions fit together. If we were to, at the end of it, when we review all the decisions, if we were to reconsider either of those, then we'd have to reconsider both. But that's the position we've ended up at so far.
Yeah. Because we also looked at the transfer or securitisation of lease receivables. Sometimes people are in the business of generating this business with the view to taking it off balance sheet, essentially, and securitising it or transferring it onto other parties. Essentially, the board's decided that what you should do in those particular circumstances is you would not measure the receivable at fair value, even if part or all of the receivable is held for the purpose of sale. And essentially what you should do is continue to apply the LD recognition requirements, which are basically for us are IFRS 9 or IAS 39. So you apply the normal derecognition requirements. The only complication is you have to allocate the carrying amount of a lease receivable on the basis of its fair value, excluding any option elements and variable lease payments that aren't transferred. Because what will often happen is that you securitise or transfer just the fixed amount of the lease payments. So that's the only sort of complication in there. You also have to apply the disclosure requirements in IFRS 7, which is our financial instruments disclosures requirements. So the full disclosure about derecognition there. In terms of presentation, we had a look at presentation by the lessors in the statement of comprehensive income, and essentially they decided that, I mentioned the accretion of the residual asset stepping up. This is the time value of money adjustment. That's treated as interest income. The amortisation of initial direct costs would be offset against the interest income, and essentially lease income and lease expense, you know, for example, the revenue or cost of sales, is either going to be shown in separate line items, as gross items, or in a single line item as a net number, depending on which presentation best reflects the lessor's business model.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, there's one more thing on leasing before we go on, and that's transition. We talked about transition for lessees and lessors and transition from current finance lease accounting and current operating lease accounting to the new model. But perhaps the only thing really that it's important that I highlight, and that is the transition for lessees when currently having operating lease accounting and then moving to the new system. In the exposure draft, we proposed a simplified retrospective approach whereby you wouldn't have to go back to the beginning of the lease and recreate all the accounting. You were able to take, at the date of transition, what the present value of the remaining lease payments were using the discount rate determined at that time. And then we said, well, set the asset amount equal to that liability. Now, that was quite good from a liability perspective. It got to a useful liability that was easier to apply. The problem was, though, that setting the asset at the same amount would have created a negative impact on the income statement in the following period that really was difficult to justify. So what we're suggesting now is to modify the calculation of the asset to take into account the age of that asset, and that would effectively eliminate the negative transition effect that would apply from the simplified approach. Of course, a better approach, I guess, would be to apply full retrospective application of the standard, because that would then get you to an even more consistent application. But I think we were concerned about not requiring full retrospective application because of the costs that were involved. So we're proposing this modified, simplified approach as compared with the original ED.
Right, just to wrap up other things discussed during the board meeting, Alan, perhaps you could rattle through quickly.
Yeah, just a couple of other things. Fair value measurement. Some people might know if they've been following our website, we've been doing a little bit of work on developing educational material to help people sort of go through the thought process of what you have to do to meet the objective of fair value measurement. Because it's a joint project, we wanted to make sure that we have a consistent approach between the FASB and the ISB, and we're going to form a working group just to help us with that material. So that's not such a working group, an advisory group, I should say. So we'll make sure that we've got other external experts that help review some of the material. We also had a look at a couple of annual improvements that will pop into the next batch of annual improvements that we expose.
And coming up?
This week is a conference in Sao Paulo. We've got Hans Hugervorst is in South America with a couple of board members and some staff, and they're presenting at a conference there. And coming up on Monday of next week, we have the ASBJ, that's the Japanese Accounting Standards Board. We'll be here in London for a day and a half of meetings. They're public meetings, and they will be webcast, I believe. So, and then on the Tuesday afternoon, we have a joint meeting with the FASB, and that's we spent a day on leases, we didn't get through everything. So we've got three papers that we're going to follow up from last week's meeting in Norwalk. And then towards the end of the week, Thursday and Friday, is the Interpretations Committee meeting here in London.
Cool. Well, thank you to Steve and to Alan. That just leaves me to give the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The only official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which will be available on the IASB website shortly. Thank you very much.